The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on September 15th, year of our Lord 2021. Good to have you with me this morning. A lot of news. Overnight, California decided to keep Gavin Newsom as its governor with 62% of the state's precincts reporting. 65, almost 66% of voters chose to keep Newsom and Ossoff. 34% wanted him out. That means Larry Elder will be coming back to the radio studio. He ran a good campaign, juiced up the base, maybe helped future elections, but Gavin Newsom stays in office. There is a huge story that will take up most of the day. What did General Milley do and when did he do it? And this is from the New York Times. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff called his Chinese counterpart in the final months of the Trump administration to reassure him that Donald Trump had no plans to attack China in an effort to remain in power, and that the United States was not collapsing, according to Peril, a new book by Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. Milley called General Li Zucheng of China on January 8th, 2 days after Mr. Trump's supporters allegedly telling him, things look messy, democracy can be sloppy sometimes, but that's the nature of democracy. We are 100% steady. If this happened, because I checked with my sources last night, the national security team did not know General Milley called China. The deputy national security advisor, Matt Pottinger, wasn't on the call, as would be routine. The assistant secretary of state for East Asia, General Stilwell, was not on the call, which would be routine. That will require General Milley to quit. He'll have to resign. If he went outside of the chain of command and called China without instruction to do so, he'll have to quit. I haven't seen him comment on it, or he'll have to be fired. That would be the most unconstitutional thing in the world. The government controls the military. We took 150 actions against China from the election forward, actions that would have been routine, many of which have continued by the Biden administration, including declaration of genocide in Uyghur against the Uyghurs, that General Milley would have had no idea what he was stumbling into. We cannot have generals calling foreign adversaries, including our most hostile adversary, and just riffing with them. So if it's true, General Milley has to go. It would be a wholesale violation of the Constitution, and I can't imagine. I mean, Stanley McChrystal was fired and the war's momentum reversed in Afghanistan because some of his low-level officers insulted the vice president, now the president, Joe Biden. We've got to all, and there's never a question about the United States military being under civilian control. This would be the biggest such scandal. And they say he pulled a Schlesinger when General Haig and General Schlesinger agreed to consult on any unusual orders when President Nixon was in his final days. That has nothing to do with that. That is one American talking to another American. The first American, Haig, being the chief of staff to the president, talking to the Secretary of Defense. Chain of command removed, one chain of command, no foreigners involved. That's a big story. We haven't heard from General Milley yet, so I'm not going to say much more about it. Big story in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. spies see signs of al-Qaeda fighters returning to Afghanistan. It's remarkable they can see anything. They didn't see this collapse of Kabul. But that's what you're going to get, an al-Qaeda giant training camp with more sophistication, more weapons. And, of course, Tony Blinken was back on Capitol Hill yesterday, getting roasted, this time by more adept questioners. Here is Mitt Romney asking Anthony Blinken for the short form of the numbers, cut number 14.
How many of them approximately, so we don't know the exact number, but how many legal permanent residents are we convinced are still in Afghanistan?
We don't have an exact number, but it's in the
thousands. Pardon?
In the thousands.
In the thousands.
Unfortunately, Senator Romney did not say 2,000, 20,000, but we left a lot of LPRs behind. And again, you know these people. They live next door to you. Green card holders. It's astonishing to me that we did that. A total abdication of America's guarantees towards not only American citizens, but its green card holders. Senator Barrasso got into it with Tony Blinken. Cut number two.
You nearly dislocated your shoulder, though, patting yourself on the back for the great job you've done. I mean, just yesterday, You stated we did the right thing by our citizens in working feverishly to get every one of them out. But you didn't get every one of them out. You've admitted again and again we're talking about over 100 Americans. The top priority must always be getting all Americans home safely.
Should have added, and thousands of LPRs. Rand Paul also lit into Tony Blinken. Cut number three.
I've advocated for an end to the Afghan war for over a decade. I'm glad it's finally over. But never in my worst nightmares could I have imagined that an administration would leave and leave $80 billion worth of weaponry to the Taliban. Dozens of planes and helicopters, thousands of armored carriers, hundreds of thousands of automatic weapons, and worst of all, 13 of our brave young men and women.
Rand Paul himself, a critic of the Afghanistan war for years, roasted Tony Blinken. I can't imagine he sticks around either. He's been reduced to a mere shade of his former self, along with General Milley, if that report is true. Department of Justice is aiding in the effort to turn the page. They've sued Texas, asking a federal judge to block the new Texas anti-abortion law. That's been up to the Supreme Court once, and they've said there's no standing yet. I haven't read the papers. I don't know what their argument is. We'll see if they come up. Pfizer is going to apply to give their vaccine to children as young as 6 months old, and I'm glad they are. I believe that vaccine will help reopen America very quickly because the COVID virus is reaching epidemic proportions across the United States. 4 out of 5 ICU beds are now taken up with a COVID patient in the United States. 4 out of 5. Israel says the coronavirus spread there has reached record heights, almost 10,000 cases a day. It's the average of 8,000 new infection a day with occasional peaks over 10,000 is going to be bigger than their second wave, the one that hit last year. But good news from Israel. We ought to just outsource the CDC, FDA and NIH to Israel. A third vaccine dose produces 10 times more antibodies than the second. And yet they're still talking about it inside this administration over at CDC. They're confused and absolutely amazed by science. They are ridiculous. We got to get those boosters out. Meanwhile, the Democrats' tax plan is coming under heavy fire because it really crushes the middle class. It will crush ordinary Americans who bought a house, saved their whole life, paid it off, and want to leave it to their kids, accumulated some 401 and IRA and saved and did it, played all by the rules. The Democrats want to do away stepped-up basis. They want to tax that house, make kids sell the house, make kids sell the IRAs, tax everything in sight. And they also want to ruin Medicare. Well, three Democrats already say they're going to oppose the party's drug price plan, which means they will lose in the House. And Democrats like Joe Manchin and other moderates are defecting from the tax hike plans. Call them and tell them to stop the tax madness. Inflation, meanwhile, has soared in Great Britain. Last month, it rose 3.2% in 1 month. Now, I don't think it's at 36% annually in Great Britain, but it just shows that it is soaring. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal has a story, what's your raise really worth? Inflation has something to say with it. For the lowest paid Americans, wages fell 0.5% when adjusted for inflation. This is because inflation is so hot in ordinary America, not the Beltway, not Silicon Valley, that it's destroying people's livelihoods. The Wall Street Journal lead editorial defining inflation down as something you ought to read as well. So, Democrats put off hard decisions on $3.5 trillion spending plan for now, according to the Wall Street Journal. They know they cannot pass taxes with this kind of an economy. A humiliating climb down, according to the Financial Times. A centrist Democrat chips away at Biden's tax plan. Richard Neal, a Massachusetts House member. New York, by the way, is going to lay out their maps today, but they're not the real maps. Gerrymandering is alive and well, despite what the left says in the Democratic Party. The real maps, according to the New York Times, are going to reduce the number of Republicans in New York State from 8 to 3 because they're going to gerrymander the hell out of it. And by the way, that's constitutional and fine. I just want Republicans to play hardball where they can play hardball. North Korea fired 2 ballistic missiles yesterday. Weakness is provocative. Joe Biden is as weak as they come. North Korea is back on its old screw with the United States and scare them into giving us money. In Iran, Iranian guards, according to the Wall Street Journal, physically harassed female UN nuclear inspectors at their giant nuclear site more than 4 times in recent months. The Turkish government announced they're building a wall along their Iranian border to keep out Afghan refugees as refugees from that Biden disaster flood into Iran, headed for Turkey. China's economic recovery is looking gloomier, according to the journal. I can't even believe how much inflation is ripping apart the world. Inflation is, of course, being powered by us. The Brits are getting serious about Chinese, though. They've thrown the ambassador, banned him from parliament. They don't want the new ambassador showing up anywhere. So that's the state of the world today. Today I'm going to talk with John Andrasik, singer-songwriter behind Blood on Our Hands, which was censored by Facebook yesterday. Facebook refused to carry an ad for the provocative, gut-punching song about America's disastrous and terribly embarrassing breach of faith with Afghans, LPRs, and American citizens. John Andrasik joins me next on the Hugh Hewitt Show to talk about Blood on Our Hands. I urge you to go and watch it on YouTube. Just type in Blood on Our Hands, Five for Fighting. You'll go and see it. And then come back. John Andrasik joins me from California, where Gavin Newsom is staying as governor after yesterday's vote. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin and Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Winking, blinking, couldn't look senators in the eye yesterday. Hi, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, back talking with John Andrasik about his new single, Blood on My Hands, which has now been censored. It can't be advertised on Facebook because it upsets the Joe Biden lovers there in the algorithm or something. John, you're talking about the generals?
I've always thought the generals are the adults in the room, and I was waiting for Milley and Austin to come out and say, look, this is what happened. It wasn't perfect. We made some mistakes, but here's what we're doing. And all they did was parrot the extraordinary success line, and that gave me chills. I was scared to death. I'm like, you're really telling me that you're going to say, what a great evac we had. We had the greatest air evac in history. Let's look at this squirrel. So then I'm like, I'm sorry. I got to say something. I kept waiting for someone else. I wish it wasn't me. I wish it was someone with much higher profile. But somebody had to say, we're breaking our promise and there's no accountability. And that's
John, I'm glad it's you, because I want to remind our audience, you're kind of the voice of 9/11. You wrote Superman, and you performed at the concert for New York, and this weekend, the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe of 20 years ago would have hit you hard. The song drops the day after the 9/11 recollection from someone who was there at Ground Zero trying to help recover. And you've done 20 years of work for our military, and people won't know this, and you never sell yourself this way, but I can tell people, an annual album for the troops. Getting everyone to give up their copyrights, visiting USO stops, going down to Gitmo, doing what you can for the troops. So you have the credentials to do this. When Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young lays down Ohio, or Neil Young lays down Let's Roll, it's from the position of being political. You're not political. You're actually not. And so I'm glad you did it. I am now astonished, though, that the reaction is to slam the door on the song. People don't want to hear it. What do you put that down to? Because it's a good song. It's haunting. It's a gut punch.
Well, again, I think, you know, unfortunately, we live in a zero-sum political world, right? You're right. I did not write the song from a political perspective. I know it'll be hard for people to believe that, but I can tell you, Hugh, if Donald Trump was president, and
you'd write the same song,
took the same actions, only the names would change. The song would be out there. And I think we know that it would probably be embraced by some other folks more than it is being now. That's disappointing to me. And I think, again, it's dangerous for our society. If everything is looked through a political lens, if everything is tribal, then you will have people echoing the, wow, what an extraordinary success. What a great airlift. Wow, we did such a good job. Everything went according to plan. And, you know, Hugh, I kind of relate it to someone on the right who, you know, stand up and say, you know, Donald Trump, you know, won in a landslide. It's the same mentality, and it's dangerous for society. If we can't look at something as simple as this and say, this is a disaster. We've broken our promise. We broke our moral code. What's the world going to think of us? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen with China? If we can't ask those questions, I fear for the survival of this country. And I know that sounds dramatic, but if we can't reflect on this and say, we screwed up, we got to do better. I mean, the president looked us in the eye, said no Americans will be left behind. 2 weeks later, Americans are left behind, and my friend's trying to rescue them. And nobody's been fired. Nobody's resigned. And what does that tell us about our leadership? Blinken today said, yeah, you know, Blinken today was saying, oh, our intelligence is giving us information. The same intelligence that blew Kabul being taken over in 2 days? What's happening?
It is catastrophic. And I think part of the reason that people don't want to think about it is not only does it represent an American defeat equal to any of my lifetime and probably worse than Vietnam, because Vietnam fell a year and a half after the Paris Peace Accords, after we had withdrawn mentally from the conflict. This is bad because 13 military men and women were killed. We know who they were, 11 Marines, one sailor, one soldier. We know who they are. That was unnecessary. It didn't happen. None of this had to happen, but it's really catastrophic. Because we know what's going to happen to the women and children of that land, and we know what's happening. They beheaded a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old yesterday. They beheaded them. And I had a doctor call in from Hawaii, worked in Kabul for 10 years, talking about the brutality of this society. We know it's going to be evil, and it's on us. We didn't have to do that. We had 2,500 troops there. I do not believe Mike Pompeo would have allowed this to happen. I do not believe. I would have been as angry as everyone is right now if we had not left a functioning government with the capacity to control the North. But I think that we're going to be haunted by a story for a long time because the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are not going to be shy about telling us what they're up to.
You know, I'm sad to say I think this song will be more relevant a year from now than it is now. I just yesterday I was talking to my friend, and she told me some horror stories that I can't, you know, get too much into because we can't kind of divulge and risk people's sources and information. But it'll all come out, and it's virtually all women and children. And it's just – it's heartbreaking because you're right. It didn't have to happen. And those are saying, well, it was going to happen no matter what. No, it didn't. Nobody forced us to abandon Bagram. Nobody forced us to not extend the deadline. It didn't have to happen. And I hope, like today, you know, Congress, you know, keeps pushing. And I do give credit to certain Democrats who understand the calamity and are not just making this a political exercise.
I give credit to Mitt Romney and Rob Portman, who very carefully laid out the fact that you went through the May deadline, and so there was no deadline. And therefore, stop telling us you had a deadline. It doesn't make any sense. And you've been in contract negotiations, I'm sure, and you've had performance issues where people say things that are non sequiturs, and you say, stop. That doesn't make any sense at all. And Blinken is trying to gut it through, and they've got Biden on ice. I mean, he's literally on ice. They won't let him out. They cut off his talk. And I had Harvey Mansfield Jr., a very old guy, 89 years old, a great professor at Harvard on Monday, to ask him, because he's a very wise man, what happens when you get old? And he says, one of the things is you lose energy and you try and limit your problem set. So you just turn the page on things. I think that's what the president has done, and he just won't think about it because he's old and he can give himself that luxury. But John, you and I can't give ourselves that. You and I both have kids and I've got grandkids, and I can't imagine the children of Afghanistan or the LRPs who are left there, or the 100 Americans, whoever knows. I can't imagine what they're doing right now.
No, and the surreal thing is, even now, I didn't get to catch a lot of Blinken because I was doing other interviews. They have not said once, we made a mistake. There's not been one, we made a mistake. It's still, well, this was going to happen, and this and this, and this is why. And I think, Hugh, I think you agree with me. If they would have come out from the beginning, right when Kabul fell, and said, look, you guys, we had an intelligence failure. We had no idea that was going to happen, and we're going to make adjustments in our plan. We're going to extend the deadline. Anybody who wants to leave is going to leave. We're going to talk to, you know, the the Taliban again about, well, they wanted us to have security over Kabul. All right, let's have security over Kabul so people can walk to the airport and get on planes. If they would have said that, even if there would have been some, even the suicide bombing, because, you know, it's a chaotic state, I think we would have at least understood, and we'd have been angry, but we would have been scared to death about this kind of Orwellian exercise. But that's still not happening, and that still scares me. You talk about it all the time. What's next?
What's next? I want to contrast it as well. W gave a speech at Shanksville this weekend, and once again, he proves himself to be the best man who's been president in my lifetime. Now, there have been better presidents, Reagan, but he's the best man because he's gracious. On 9/11, and I know you watch this, and in every day since, he has never blamed Bill Clinton. He has never blamed Al Gore for the transition screw-up. He has never said anything was anybody's fault, that 9/11 was the fault of Al-Qaeda. Everything that Joe Biden has said since this catastrophe began to unfold is it's all Donald Trump's fault. That is moral cowardice. That's why I like your song. I do not like the fact that Facebook won't let you advertise it. Now, you are being as gracious as W, and you're not calling that censorship, but I will, because they have a platform and they're choosing not to let you advertise on that. Have they given you an explanation as to why they won't let you promote Blood on My Hands?
No, they've not. And again, I would assume it's some algorithm. I got to say, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air wrote a piece with some very relevant questions, sharing some other posts that were advertised that certainly were more political than mine, and asking Facebook, well, why this one and not John Song? And again, I'm not a elected official or work for a party. I wrote a song. I'm a singer-songwriter. It's what I do for a living. I put it on Facebook. They didn't take my post down. And I just wanted to share it because people are reacting to it, and I want people to hear it. And they wouldn't let me do that. I'm not telling anybody how to vote. There's no election. And you got to tell me that everybody who wants to write a song that talks about social issues can't promote their song. So, again, I hope it's just some algorithm failure. But to this point, they have not reached out to me. And hopefully Ed's article and you talking about it will allow me to just, you know, share my song. And if not, give me a rational reason why that we can digest and talk about.
They would have to say that Nixon's Coming Four Dead in Ohio wouldn't have been advertised in 1971 or 70, whatever year that was. They would have to make arguments about the refusal to use the platform is always a neutral decision. And that is, in fact, singer-songwriters have forever been voicing emotional reactions to horrific events, and they're not always correct.
As they should be. You know, as they should. If somebody wanted to write a song and say, hey, this was an extraordinary success, look what a great evac we did, yay, yay, they should write that and people should comment on it. And the problem is, as you know, there's been such a history of, you know, pseudo-censorship of people that are in the middle or on the right that when something like this happens, it's hard to give them the benefit of the doubt. But I'm doing so. Let's see what happens tomorrow, and hopefully, you know, we'll put this behind us.
I'll come back with John Andrzejczyk in a moment and finish the interview. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
Got blood in my hands.
Welcome back, America. Tony Blinken's withering cross-examination by the House and yesterday by the Senate is over, but not my interview with John Andrzejczyk, author of the now-censored by Facebook song, Blood on My Hands. Here's the conclusion of that interview. John, I am worried that elite media has transformed slowly over the years into a barricade for the center, left, and left. And that if you're not inside the fort, you're considered enemy hostiles outside of the fort. Do you see that happening? Do you worry you're going to be defined?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, again, it's you know, I take solace in my dog hasn't canceled me yet. But I think, you know, look, as I said, I wrote this song from a moral perspective, and I really hoped that some of the mainstream media would take it that way. And we sent it out to all of them. And I've said, I'll do anybody's show. Look, I'll do Rachel Maddow's show. I think she was crying when she saw the pictures of Afghanistan, the women there. She understands the plight of Afghanistan. She may not agree with some of my comments, but it's something we have to discuss. And I think it's something we have to keep in front of us because our nature is to just turn the page. And it's such a broken promise. And the human rights, the human cost, the refugees, what's going to happen? It's a humanitarian crisis now. And we can't look at this as a political exercise and a bullet in the war, you know, the culture war. This is a humanitarian crisis. We put them there, and it's our job to do all we can to prevent what's happening right now. And I don't know how we do it, but if we stop talking about it, certainly nothing's going to help.
The most important thing about the song, John, it's not really about us. It's about 9 and 10 year olds being beheaded, women being raped.
Yes.
It's about the chilling photograph in the Telegraph on Monday. Women are allowed in Kabul University. They are beyond the burqas now. They're hooded, and they're wearing black robes. Only a few of them had slits for their eyes. The Taliban thought they were putting out a good photo for their, you know, here we are, modern. And women are allowed to attend cricket matches, but only if they are taken there by a man. So there are no women. It's almost unbelievable. We're so not used to this. It's like the Uyghurs in China. If we don't see it, it's not happening. But that's not true, especially when you have the capacity to know that it's happening. So,
well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you basically just said the line of my song, you know. I can't hear her scream if she's not on TV. And
that is, in fact, the crescendo of your song. And I tell people, listen to she's not on TV. He's not on TV. I can't hear her screaming. And we don't. And
No. We're
taught, Christians are taught to pray for the imprisoned, the people that you forget. And I think about the Uyghurs every day because I know people who know stuff about them. But now there's an entire country on which darkness is descending. And I don't know when the lights are going back on there, John. It could be 500 years.
And who knows what it's going to spread to? And who knows now that we basically ceded to the Taliban what Iran's going to do, what Russia's going to do? You know, this could be just a drop in the bucket, which is just horrifying to think about. But, you know, I salute you, Hugh. I know we're friends. I know we have a similar worldview. But you launching this song, sometimes a song can change the world. And I wish it was a better song by a bigger songwriter, but this is all we got. And I think the song with you and some other folks, you know, keeping it out there and it's growing every day. We had 2,000 views last night. Now we were over 50,000 today, and it's growing. And my emails are rolling in, you know, from military families, from liberals, from moderates, from conservatives. So it's touching a vein. And maybe this song can, you know, make sure we have some accountability, keep the Afghans in our hearts. More importantly, do some action that will prevent exactly what you're talking about. I don't know what that is, but I think if this movement grows, as I said, it's a humanitarian crisis and it's on us.
And if nothing else, this government dare not turn its back on anybody who they have left behind who has a chance of getting out through the help of people like your friend. And I know some people are working on very – it's more than 100 Americans. It's thousands of LPRs. It's tens of thousands of Afghans. And it's millions going forward. So you're doing your best, John. I'm glad to help you with that. Let's check in a few weeks and see how it's going. Thank you for joining me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And good luck. I'll see you on tour when you're out on the road.
Give my love to Betsy. Thank you, Hugh.
I will. Be well, John. John Androsik is really one of the best people in entertainment. And the amount that he does on behalf of troops over 20 years, the albums that he puts together, he runs around to all of his fellow platinum record people and he gets them to give up the rights of their song so he can produce albums for the troops who are deployed. He's been doing it for 20 years. He's genuinely an American hero in terms of the entertainment industry being like it was back in the day of World War II and people putting everything into it, and for Facebook not to carry the ad. I just can't even begin to say to you how big this cover is of a cover-up is what's going on. This terrible. I'm going to play some more audio from yesterday's Blinken Senate testimony when we come back. Stay tuned, America. Hour number two continues on The Hugh Hewitt Show on Wednesday, September the 15th.
What's happening?
Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Representative Mike Gallagher, with whom I usually have some fun at the start, but we have some serious stuff to talk about, beginning with this story in the Washington Post, Congressman Gallagher, about General Milley, drawn from the new book Peril by Woodward and Costa. Now, you know General Milley, you're a member of the Armed Services Committee, you are a Marine. What do you make of this story? What possible response can he have short of resignation? What facts could change that would stop that from having to happen today?
Well, if it's true, it's one of the more serious allegations that I've heard regarding the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the chain of command in modern history. And I think if it's true, and again, we're operating off, I have no reason to doubt the reporting of Costa and Woodward, but that alone is not grounds for certainly legal action, but it is grounds for a thorough investigation, because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs does not get to freelance with our adversaries and undermine a sitting commander-in-chief. That simply cannot happen, and this can't be allowed to stand. So at a minimum, the relevant committees in Congress need to demand the release of documents, transcripts from reported calls, and a full testimony before the House Armed Services Committee. And I don't know why General Milley has not yet publicly made a statement. I get that he is pushing back now. It appears Jennifer Griffin has some reporting that suggests this isn't true, that there were 15 people on a video teleconference call, including people from the State Department, and that there are readouts and notes from these two calls between Milley and his Chinese counterparts. Well, if so, these call notes, if these call notes exist, they should be requested by Congress. I would say this, Hugh, I think regardless of what we understand when we get to the bottom of this, General Milley, due to a combination of things, whether it's sort of his defense of woke ideology in Congress and some other things, has become very politicized. And I think it's clear to me that he is the one leaking a lot of this to a lot of people in the media, to thinking that this will portray himself in a good light, that he somehow saved the Republic at a time of profound peril surrounding January 6th. You simply can't have that. And it's very damaging to the chain of command. It also is just damaging to the general respect that Americans have for the military. And we are getting very close to politicizing the military at the top levels in a way that's going to do lasting damage to the credibility of American commitments and the effectiveness of American deterrence around the world. So we really do need to demand a clear denial, at least from Milley. And that's his only option. It's a full-throated denial or a resignation.
A full-throated explanation. He may have made these calls. Now, I spoke last night with a senior member of the Trump administration national security team who told me calls between the chairman and counterparts, including the Chinese counterpart, would not be untoward if they included either the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the Assistant Secretary of State, General Stilwell, for East Asia Affairs, or Matt Pottinger, the National Security Advisor, Deputy National Security Advisor, in on the call, taking notes, and having briefed Milley before the call occurred, because more than 150 specific actions were taken vis-a-vis China after the election before the transition, into which Milley might not have been able to cogently weighed had he not been briefed by state or NSC staff. But if he was surrounded by the interagency protocols, that explanation will be sufficient to defend him. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do think it would be it would be sufficient to defend him. I mean, I would have to know the details of the call. And certainly that all depends on the assumption that the national security team is as a whole still operating under the direction, or at least the commander's intent, of the commander-in-chief, right? Because you don't want a situation in which the entire national security team is going rogue, even amidst the unique circumstances of January 6th. But yes, I agree with your basic point. And I could see the value of having a direct channel of communication to the PLA. Obviously, we want to make sure that we don't have misunderstandings that lead to war. But we simply cannot have a situation where, on his own volition, outside of the president's national security team, outside of the chain of command, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is going VFR direct to his Chinese counterparts and assuring them that we are not going to take any military actions. That's just simply not something that can happen, and it directly undermines the authority of the commander-in-chief, if true. And again, we're operating off of Woodward and Costa book. I have no reason to doubt their reporting, but I don't take it, you know, as 100% fact. We have to do our own investigation. We have to get to the bottom of this because we can't have generals freelancing and going outside the chain of command.
Agreed. So we need either an acceptable explanation or resignation by the end of the day. You also cannot leave a story like this lying around waiting for oversight in 3 weeks. That's because if he's a rogue general, he's a rogue general and it's got to go. But if he's not, then they can explain it fairly quickly. Now, Congressman Gallagher, we haven't got all the time in the world today. So I just want you to assess your reaction to Secretary Blinken's, I think, disastrous 2 days of testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee over Monday and Tuesday of this week.
Yeah, I thought it was terrible. I thought the fact that, you know, I thought Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin captured it when he talked about the disparity between the real world and the way in which Secretary Blinken portrayed this in his written testimony. The idea that the administration is still out there trying to spin this as a success and not acknowledging the fiasco of this withdrawal is actually offensive. And I think it should offend every American with an ounce of common sense. The fact that we still don't have precise numbers on how many Americans we left behind, how many SIV eligible Afghans we left behind, how many green card holders, how many LPRs we left behind. That should offend every American.
Can we stop there for a second? Can I criticize your colleagues and I in both the Senate and the House? What does it take for someone to say, you said thousands of LPRs? Is that 2,000 or is that 25,000? I mean, why can't your colleagues follow up a question with a question? I mean, it was so frustrating to watch.
Yeah, I think that we need to send people to the Hewitt School of cross-examination. Maybe you could run like a boot camp for
Well, it's not that hard. I mean, do you know how many thousands there are now after 2 days of testimony and 25 different questions? Do you, Mike Gallagher, member of Congress, know how many Americans within 10 and how many LPRs within 100 we have left behind?
I do not, which is remmable to me.
That's a failure of Congress. That's a failure of Congress, man. That is not hard. I've been talking to you for 6 minutes. We've established that you don't know, and we could have established that Blinken didn't know in about 2 minutes.
Yeah. it really is a failure. And, you know, the administration will say it's hiding behind the argument that, well, when people go to Afghanistan, they don't always register with the embassy, and then some people leave, and we don't know. It's just unacceptable. It's completely unacceptable.
So let me conclude. I want to ask you this in a big picture way. We have seen a catastrophe in Afghanistan. They beheaded an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old yesterday, and it's going to get worse. We have a new Post story that Wall Street Journal story, Al Qaeda is already reassembling in Afghanistan. They've got all this armament. We've got hundreds of American hostages, and LPRs are Americans, whether or not you call them citizens, they're Americans. We have a fiasco disaster in our hand, and we have an incompetent Congress. We have a politicized military. I don't recall being this alarmed since Jimmy Carter and the Soviets invading Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution. And you're too young to remember that. But it's really a dark moment.
Well, Hugh, I'm not too young. The first time I ever came on your program when I was a humble civilian with Ambassador Robert O'Brien was to talk about an article that we had written together, which was an argument that Obama should learn from Jimmy Carter. Because the remarkable thing is that in the very late stages of Jimmy Carter's presidency, after the invasion of Afghanistan, after multiple foreign policy crises, after the Iran hostage crisis, he actually learned from the failure and started to do things differently and started to make investments in defense that Reagan then took up and increased and obviously perfected our strategy for defeating the Soviets over the subsequent decade. What we saw with Obama then was a complete unwillingness to learn from failure because he was blinded by progressive ideology and a sense of his own infallibility. And I worry we're going to see the same thing with Joe Biden, who may not be quite as self-confident as Obama was, but still wants to cement his place in history as even more progressive as President Biden, and seems to dig in even when confronted with manifest failures of foreign policy. And the fact that they're trying to spin this failure, pivot to their incredibly progressive and destructive economic agenda is very telling and very troubling. And I do think, whether it's Milley or Blinken or others, in order to be successful, they are going to have to admit that their current national security team is not appropriately constructed. And I think it would Amen. Be wise for the president to go back to the drawing board and try and rebuild a actual bipartisan national security team. I think that's what the moment demands, because the threats we face, Hugh, I actually think are more complex than the late 70s. I think the challenge we face from China in particular is so complex and so difficult, it is going to take our best and our brightest, and it's going to take both parties rowing their oars in the same directions, and that's not happening right now.
It is not happening, and you are absolutely right, and I hope so. Add to the ideology the infirmity of the president, and we have a crisis. Mike Gallagher, Congressman Extraordinaire from Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, thank you.
Hear the latest reporting and analysis on the big stories of the day on the Daybreak Insider podcast. It's top-notch reporting from SRN News, along with the sharpest insight from Hugh Hewitt, Mike Gallagher, Dennis Prager, Sebastian Gorka, and the voices of townhall.com. The Daybreak Insider podcast. It's your first look at today's top stories. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and at salempodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. On October the 13th, I am going to be joined in Atlanta by Brian Westbury of First Trust Portfolio, Alfredo Ortiz of Job Creators Network. Alfredo's going to a lot more places on the Job Creators Network bus tour, so go to jcnbustour.com if you want to find out where. But if you want tickets to hear Brian and I talk about the inflationary cycle we are in, and Alfredo to talk about Job Creators, go to am920theanswer.com. We're going to be at the Atlanta History Center. It's a ticketed event, and the tickets are flying out the door because it's only got a few hundred people in there. am920theanswer.com. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. I am excellent. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I've got one story. It's jumping out at me from the Telegraph in Great Britain this morning. in August in Great Britain, prices jumped 3.2%. Now, on an annualized basis, of course, that gets us up to the 38%. One explanation being offered by inflation deniers is, oh, that's just the annual inflation rate for restaurants, cafe, and dancing establishments because we ran an Eat Out to Help Out campaign to help reopen Britain in August. I'm not buying that. 3.2% in 1 month, Brian, is catastrophic for Great Britain.
Yeah, we have, Hugh, we have inflation accelerating all over the world, and it's really based on two things, but one is the most important, and that is central banks around the world. So in the UK, it's the Bank of England. Here, it's the Federal Reserve, have printed and injected into the economy trillions and trillions of dollars and euros. And we have done that at the same time we have held back production. And so what we have is massive increase in the demand for things. Everyone has cash, but very, very contained and restrained production of things. And when you have a demand increasing and production being restrained, the end result is inflation. It happens every time.
It's a law. It's right. It's economics 101, right?
Yep. It's like when the apple finally breaks free of its limb, it hits the ground. It's gravity.
And so, Brian, add on to
what inflation is.
In Germany, they have an election in 2 weeks. It is likely to be a sharp swing to the left. Merkel being defeated. Merkel's coalition, she's retiring, her coalition being defeated. They're going to go sharply to the left. And we're going to have a huge tax increase. I don't think this is even difficult to predict. We are going to have stagflation.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, we're heading into the wilderness again. And Hugh, I mean, this goes back. The history of mankind is the battle between wealth creation, which can only be done by entrepreneurship and freedom, and the redistribution of that wealth, which is done by government. And whenever government gets more power, and today they're using climate change, they're using COVID, they're using inequality, they're using all kinds of different political arguments to get more power. And as government grows, the economy slows. That's the stag part of stagflation. And then as money is printed, because, you know, remember, when government interferes, they cause problems with the economy. So then they think they can fix it by printing more money. And then that causes the inflation. And so what we end up with is stagflation. Too much government holding down the economy, too much money trying to fix that with it. It's like giving somebody morphine after a car accident, right?
It is. When we see AOC go to the Metropolitan Ball, she's been comped a $30,000 ticket and she wears a tax the rich gown. That is disintermediated from any kind of common sense. It's cognitive dissonance. But then when I say to them, the Wall Street Journal story headline this morning, what's your raise really worth? Inflation has something to say about it for the lowest paid Americans. The lowest paid Americans, real wages, right, fell 0.5% in August. They're screwing the working class, Brian Westbury.
That is what always happens. You cannot successfully redistribute the wealth in a country without causing massive economic problems, which then definitely affects those on the lower part of the income scale more. The economy only works for people when it's free, and you have to work. See, this is the thing: if we pay people to not work, we are literally undermining their ability to become rich. If you just sit at home and collect the government check, you'll never be rich.
You'll be dependent.
You become a dependent, and that creates inequality. The number one problem with inequality in America is that we have spent tens and tens of trillions of dollars trying to fix it.
And what we have done is we've created a permanent group of people that we've made it harder for them to grow their wealth.
Westbury on Twitter, WESBURY, and he and I will be in Atlanta along with Alfredo Ortiz of the Job Creator Network on October the 13th. Go get your tickets. AM920TheAnswer.com. You got to hear this at length, and we will do it at length. I'll be right back. A big hour ahead. Canada Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this September 15th. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, I'll be joined by essayist Andrew Sullivan, back on the show for the first time in 15 years. His new book, Out on a Limb, must reading for anyone who considers himself well-read. But I have been so pessimistic in the last 2 weeks, I asked Joe Lonsdale to join me. He is the host of the podcast, American Optimist. More importantly than that, Joe is actually an American optimist. He's one of the new tech guys. He built many a good company, including one, which I must disclose I'm invested in, Palantir, which he started up with my pal Peter Thiel, and he's done a lot of other VC stuff. Then he moved from Silicon Valley to Texas. He's got his finger in a lot of different things, and for a Stanford guy, he's awfully engaging on the podcast. So I invited Joe Lonsdale to join me. Good morning, Joe. It's great to have you on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning, Hugh. Great to be here.
Now, Joe, I first want to talk about American Optimist, because you don't have to do anything. You're a wealthy investor. You've got companies to run. You've got a young family and a wonderful wife, and I like you, the Cicero Project. I like all that stuff. Why in the world did you start doing a podcast?
You know, there's just so many cool things happening in America, and everyone seems to be negative and cynical and pessimistic right now. And I thought maybe, you know, I have all these friends who are celebrities and who have built all these great things and are making our future pretty awesome. I thought I should probably share some of that to give people a different perspective.
Well, you're a man after my own heart. People have said for 20 years that I've been on the radio, 30 years that I've been in broadcast, that I'm always the happiest guy in broadcast. But I must tell you, how old are you, Joe?
I just turned 39.
Okay, so I'm 65. I've got three grandkids. When I was 39, I was a happy-faced, happy-go-lucky, starting a radio career, having done the Reagan years. America, it was morning in America. The Soviet Empire was falling apart. Now I'm 65 and I got grandkids to worry about. And I must tell you, it's been a bad run for America. Do you agree with me on that?
There have been some embarrassing things our leadership has done and failed to do. I'll definitely agree with that. And there's definitely been a way that America's been polarized and pulled apart by some things as well. So there's definitely some challenges right now.
Yeah, it's the most divided the country has been in my lifetime. But on top of that, Americans will come together when they have to. There are economic forces at work. Disintermediation is so massive, and you're part of them. I mean, Palantir is basically going to change the way that first the American government, then every American company gets and assesses its information. Does that disintermediation of the old from the new worry you at all? It's got huge changes implicit within it.
Well, I mean, it'd worry me if we weren't disintermediating the old right now, because that's how you get economic growth. That's how you get progress, is you take things that aren't working as well as they could, and you improve them. And there's so many areas of the economy where we're doing that right now with a lot of different types of companies. And so I think overall that's a positive thing.
Well, let's talk about moving your company from California to Texas. You are not a conservative. I want people to understand you're kind of a progressive libertarian, as far as I can tell, and a free market guy. All right. So that's kind of it's just a non sequitur, but it makes sense to me. Progressive libertarian free market guy. But it occurs to me you moved, because you're a realist, from my old state, California, as I did, to a new state, Texas. I moved to Virginia because of the governing class in California. Am I right about that?
Yeah, you know, California has just a lot of special interests, a lot of incompetence. They've ruined life for the middle class there. I hire a lot of people, and I didn't feel it was, I mean, my wife and I didn't feel it was morally right to be financially supporting this mess. And, you know, coming to Texas for me is, you know, it is a way to make a stand for liberty and to make a stand for America. I think we have to protect Texas values if we're going to have America win overall.
You see, we are a freedom people, and I like the fact you went to Austin. You run into McConaughey down there, if you haven't already. He's a freedom guy, too, and I think he's a Democrat. He's a freedom guy, and you might be a Democrat, too. I don't care. Most of my friends are Democrats. My question is, how do you get Texas to stay Texas if all the Californians bring their half-baked ideological extremism with them?
you know, and I'm probably some liberty version of the moderate right, to be honest. But what's interesting is that Senator Ted Cruz would have actually lost his last election if only the people born in Texas voted. It's actually, you look at the numbers, over the last 20 years, people who have come here tend to be slightly more on the pro-liberty side, and they actually voted more for Senator Cruz as an example. So I think that so far the people are choosing to come to Texas because they share Texas values. It's pretty interesting.
I hope you're right. Virginia is trending very blue because of the growth of government, and that's why California went deep blue. Yep. It's just government grew at such a rapid pace. One of the consequences of that, of course, is one of the young engineers who you want to hire, they can't buy a house in California. I mean, they'll never be able to buy a house in California. I'll tell you the story of one young couple I know. She worked at Google, still does, for 6 years. He worked at Lockheed. They saved all of her money, and they were able to put a down payment on a little ranch Rambler after 6 years. Joe, that doesn't work for the American dream.
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely a problem in the Bay Area, and it's offensive. We had people working with us, you know, pay pretty well, and if you're not making more than a few hundred K, you have to drive half an hour and a half in one case for one group to come work with us, which is just unacceptable.
Well, this radio show has a 12 share in San Francisco, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning right now in San Francisco. It has a 12 share because people have to drive to San Francisco and the Silicon Valley from, you know, an hour and a half away. That's just not a way to live. That's too much of your life in a car. Joe, tell me go ahead.
Well, you know, one thing I'm really bullish on, which I'm involved with, is with Elon Musk, you know, his tunneling company. It sounds crazy to people, but I actually think that's one of the solutions here. If you could do much, much cheaper, more affordable tunnels, you could actually live middle-class lifestyle pretty far outside of a city, and you can commute at 120 miles an hour underground, and that, you know, directly to where you're going. It might actually solve these problems partially, at least. I think California's too incompetent to ever allow us to build the tunnels, but I bet you we're going to be able to build them other places and prove it out.
Well, that is exactly true. I was a land use lawyer in California for 30 years until I retired at the same time I was a broadcaster. Nothing big will ever be built in California again. Nothing, unless there's a complete revolution. Tell me about the Cicero project, because this is what really attracted me. American Optimist podcast is fascinating. We'll come back in the next segment and talk about podcasting. But I want to know about the Cicero project.
Cicero is a policy group that my wife and I and a lot of friends are involved in. And the basic idea there is pretty much every problem you see in our country, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's how you run the prison and criminal justice system, the lack of innovation in these areas is because the government's in charge of these areas and they're not letting the best ideas compete and win. The way America progresses is the best ideas win and the bad ideas lose, and you try better ways of doing things and those ways prevail. And when you have government running something, you don't have market forces and you don't have transparency and accountability, it breaks these areas. And so what we're doing is we're going in at a state level, we're drafting legislation, and we're figuring out system level ways for good ideas to win. Let me give you an example. In Texas, the technical schools, which is the vocational type schools, were not doing so well about 8 years ago. And they went in and they said, we're going to fund our technical schools based on the salaries of the students coming out. So what that did, it created transparency and it created an incentive for the schools to have to actually teach skills that mattered. After they put that law in place and that funding was tied to student success, the schools changed what skills they were teaching. The salaries doubled over the last 8 years coming out of these schools. And so there's laws like that that we're drafting and we're bringing to a lot of states to try to make these areas actually have competition of ideas.
God bless you. That, by the way, in a nutshell, is indeed the answer, is that government suffocates innovation. And without innovation, all of the amazing advances in the United States of America do not get into the sectors where they are most necessary. But I'm a student of ancient Rome. Yeah, well, I'm a student of ancient Rome, Joe. You know what happened to Cicero? He ended up dead with his hands cut off and his tongue cut out, nailed to the wall.
I probably should have called it the Augustus Caesar Institute, but that would have been a little bit too much for people.
Well, it's just that people who speak truth to power end up really pissing off power, and then they end up on the outside. Are you an optimist that leaders of both parties and those of no party at all will listen to an innovative public policy solution that's not tied to special interest money?
I'm an optimist that we can prove out these ideas with smart people on both sides. I'll tell you what, though, Hugh, it's frustrating. I get a lot of moderate Democrats who agree with these ideas, and the far left is very good at killing off any kind of accountability. I'm actually friends with a lot of prominent moderate Democrats, and they say, Joe, we have to do these things in the red states first. You know, I mean, just as an example, I shouldn't throw him under the bus, but I have a very proud and moderate Democrat friend, and he's really interested in innovating prisons, because prisons, you know, there's all sorts of ways that prisons can be run so much better and much more innovative, better ways for rehabilitating and for getting people jobs when they come out and for not radicalizing them. And he says, Joe, I'd love to do this in the blue states with you, but first we have to prove it in the red states, because my friends on the far left will kill your accountability, they'll kill your transparency. They don't want to hold government accountable. So unfortunately, we tend to have more progress right now, particularly on the moderate red states, and then we're going to try to take those ideas to the blue states as well.
That's a good plan, no doubt. It's because you know how to roll out a beta and then move it to success. I'll be right back with Joe Lonsdale, his podcast, American Optimist. Don't go anywhere, because we need this on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.